You are listening to KBTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews around the sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can listen on Tuesdays and Sundays after 12. Today, I'm so pleased to be talking by Zoom to Elise Guttenberg. She's a friend from Alaska, and I've always admired her writing. Recently, she's the author of The Power We Share. It's just been published, and I had such a good time reading it. It's one of the only books that I could read in the last month and actually enjoy and get through and not get all upset. So thank you so much, Elise, for this release into high fantasy. Welcome. And I'd like you to begin by reading from the very beginning of the book, because I think that really sets the stage.
Thank you so much for the invitation. And I have to say, especially in these COVID times, I really appreciate the opportunity to reach out to readers and folks around Alaska and outside in Port Townsend. It's just right around the corner from us. So yeah, I'm going to start from the beginning of The Power We Share. And it starts with a poem, a little epigraph that's repeated through the book and encapsulates a lot of the ideas that are in here. So here we go. Those of us who are not witches give birth to sons and daughters who are. We are one people, from the living stars who traveled the dark lights, raised high the isles, bequeathed us their gift. We are sons born ready to prove our craft, daughters to master our own. We are water that births us, fire that cleanses us, sky that sustains us, ice that surrounds us. We rejoice in the power we share. Chapter 1, Equinox. Wherein Molly Sinclair is a pirate and a witch. Molly Sinclair followed the young lady around the ballroom floor. Her necklace looked perfect, gold chain, sparkling gems, and with no sign of a locking spell on the catch, it shouldn't be difficult to steal. Her dance partner wouldn't matter. He was a foppish looking man with no rhythm, and she kept glancing past his shoulder as if she couldn't wait for the waltz to end. She turned to see if any guards were paying attention. There were two at a nearby column, but they weren't looking her way, and one at the fountain was too busy watching the women to be a concern. The music faded, and she smoothed her clothes and trailed a cautious 10 steps behind the dancers as they left the crowded floor. Molly had chosen low boots over white stockings for the evening, fitted trousers that reached just below her knees, and a brocade surcoat that was a perfect match to the clothes worn by other guests, the men, not the women. They wore flashing jewels that smelled of wealth and sleek gowns that showed off her breasts. Hers were hidden beneath a layer of tight undergarments, and she wasn't particularly pleased with the fit. A serving boy rode through the knot of guests, his tray heaped with seaweed-wrapped scallops and rounds of lobster. Molly paused and helped herself to one of each and searched the hall for her brother. She didn't see him and glanced to the run of tall windows. Stars glimmered, and the moon was clear in the autumn sky. There wasn't a hint of fog, but that was all right. Evan still had time. All he had to do was craft his spell and hold it while she worked hers, and they'd be safely away from the governor's ball before anyone noticed they'd been robbed. She wasn't worried about being recognized. She'd lengthened her nose and squared her chin, changed her copper hair to an unassuming brown, and looked nothing like her real self. The young lady she'd been following took a seat beside a silver-haired woman who seemed bored with the evening. They waited for the gentleman to leave, then turned their attention to a younger man leaning against a chair. Molly coughed to lower her voice, then stepped forward and asked for the honor of a dance. The lady, Deborah Loam, looked Molly over and beamed with pleasure. She glanced at her companion, gathered her skirt, and walked daintily beside Molly to the floor. Candles and oil lamps lit the jade columns in spacious hall. Richly dressed couples moved toward the center, and guests clustered around tables laden with food. A spell-infused fountain bubbled with scented water, and goldfish swam upward through the streams. Musicians raised their lutes, and the lilting notes of another waltz began. Molly took her partner's hand, and the steps brought them out, then together. Molly was taller than Miss Sloane, taller than most women, in fact, and she glanced inconspicuously at the necklace around her throat. The gems seemed real, and her left arm was clear of any guild mark, which meant she was human, not witch. Perfect. She wouldn't notice Molly's spell. Deborah Loam inquired whether the gentleman, Molly gave her name as Hark Quintel, was enjoying himself, and Molly answered with a simple, yes. And did Mr. Quintel live nearby? Not actually, Molly replied. Miss Loam seemed disappointed. Molly executed another turn and studied the back of her neck. Gems hung from a ribbon, the ribbon from a gold chain, and just above that, tucked in her plaited hair, was the smallest enameled shell Molly had ever seen. And inside the shell, Molly searched for a hint of magic and felt it, a locking spell, too simple to be a problem, holding it all in place. Quickly, before the dance ended, she blew a short, firm breath, and this time, as she brought Deborah Loam around, she fixed the pattern of gems and gold, bezel and chain, firmly in her thoughts. Concentrated, and a moment later, a second necklace, scarcely different from the first, circled Miss Loam's throat. The real necklace slid into Molly's hand, from her hand to the pouch on her belt, and she was done. The music ended. Molly led Miss Loam back to her seat and fled into the crowd. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Elise. Wow, that was very visual. And I can see the hall and the jade columns, and I can see the dancers, and then you introduce the magic so subtly, but it is very complex. And so this is kind of like an introduction, right? To get filled out more later. Tell us basically about the various settings in the book. This one is in the governor's palace or governor's hall, right? But mostly it takes place in a watery world, and you live in interior Alaska. So you did a lot. So tell us about the Isles and why you decided to set it in the Isles.
Well, interestingly enough, it's, and I'm going to walk a path between giving away too much of the story and answering your questions. This is very much set in a real place. It's not a fantasy world where everything is created from the get-go, as I've done in some of my earlier books. And so I used a real map. And there is magic and a thousand-year-old mythology that tells the history of this place. And because I wanted to put it in our real world, I had to look for where it was going to be. So it had to be isolated and it had to be hidden. And because I knew I was going to be writing about pirates, which was the very germinal idea for this story, I had to think, oh, okay, where am I going to put my pirates? It's not going to be in interior Alaska, which is locked and far away from the sea. It's going to be where pirates are. So I need a watery place. And I need to enclose it to have the magic work in this world that I created. And so I put a wall of ice around it and hid it with a mythology. And in there, I have pirates sailing from one isle to the next and hiding and having battles at sea.
Oh, I want to know where it is. That's not fair.
So if you get your hands on the book, open up the map and see if you can guess.
Okay. I will do that. And I will ask everyone in our audience to do that as well. So there we are in the Isles, and we are also in a secret cove, and we're in towns, but there's also these places, the guild halls. Can you tell us about those? I think one is called Haddon Hall, am I correct?
Hayden, yes.
Haddon Hall, okay.
That's all right. So there's a mythology in this magical place in the Isles with a capital at the center called Jamisac, and it's populated. And over the time, the guild has There's a lot of politics in the background of the story, by the way. And the guild is controls the magic in the aisles, and they have their holes pretty much on every aisle. And they are fighting for control. And in the setting of the story, magic has been around for 1,000 years, but it's beginning to fade. So there's a lot of intrigue and who's cheating who and who's more powerful. So as Molly is a pirate, wants to, she's going to get some gold. She's going to need some money and do her pirate thing and the thieving thing. So she's on her ship called the Fish, going from aisle to aisle and setting up home bases, while her brother, who is in the younger apprentice, which is at the guild halls where they bring up apprentices. So he's traveling, she's traveling, and we go from aisle to aisle learning about the different places.
Yeah, we're used to reading in fantasy where the witches and the wizards have a great deal of power. And I like the way you flipped it here and made them being controlled by the government and the palace, and how they had tattoos on their arms, not exactly tattoos, but the marks on their arms. That was fascinating to me. I really enjoyed that. So the sailing ships, you mentioned the Fish, and the Fish is a caravel. Am I right about that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you also live in Interior Alaska, and our audience here will be interested in how you introduced all of these sailing ships from, I think, between the 15th century, mm-hmm. around the 15th century,
yes.
you know, kind exactly. of that time, Spanish Armada, mm-hmm. kind of.
Exactly, right.
Yes, and right. and so you have a caravel, I think you have a carrack, galleon mm-hmm. frigates, all mm-hmm. kinds of things. We have the Adventurous here mm-hmm. and a tall ship.
Yes.
It's not always here, and also the Lady Washington. Mm-hmm. And so we are, and a lot of sailing ships and the Wooden Boat Festival. So people will be loving to read this, the detail of the mm-hmm. sailing ships. How did you get the feel of, and all the little places on the boats? That was really, really evocative and wonderful. I felt like I was there.
Oh, thank you. And it was great fun. And so I should say, I grew up on the East Coast in New York, and my husband grew up in Connecticut. He grew up with a family that sailed. And so even though I live in landlocked Alaska, we both love the water, the ocean. And my husband especially, he grew up building boats. Now those were sailing boats, you know, not giant three-masted tall ships, of course. But I've always been drawn to ships like that. And because Molly was a pirate, and again, the germinal idea for the story was that I would be writing about a woman who was a pirate. That's where the story began. So I knew I'd be on ships. To find out more about them, whenever over the past few years I got to travel, whether it was into the Pacific Northwest or even as far down as San Diego, I would go looking for where there were tall ships. And I walked on several of them, museum ships on the East Coast, down around San Diego in the Pacific Northwest. I'd get myself on ships that were park museums. So you're right though, this is the 15, 1600s. Picture something like what Christopher Columbus was sailing. Pictures ships of that size, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria. Those were actually models. I got myself a lot of books. I hung posters of the interior ships on my walls, and I just really immersed myself in what would I feel like, and not just in the physical part of the ships, but I read a lot of books about sailing itself, how to do that. You have to be careful when you're doing research, because it's a trap. You can spend just too much time very easily and not get back to the writing, because it's so much fun and so intriguing. But I wanted to feel the wind, and I wanted to hear the wood and the ship creaking as they sailed, and to also read about how in that era people slept in hammocks, let's say, and the hammocks hung around cannons, and the cannons would have portholes and things like that. It was just great fun immersing myself in that world. So
I can imagine. Yeah. So you're listening, dear listeners, to Book Lovers Cafe. This is your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we're talking to Elise Guttenberg. She's the author of The Power We Share, and she's also written other books, Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed, and two about prehistoric Alaska, Summer Light, and Daughter of the Shaman. And so let's talk a little bit about that part of your life, Elise, when you started writing these books when you were young. Mm-hmm. How did it all begin?
Yeah, well, I'm one of those people who was always a writer, always wanted to be a writer, wrote stories since I was a kid. It's all I ever intended to do, knew how to do, ever wanted to do. So even going through as an undergraduate up here in Fairbanks, and then graduate school, and then having kids, as soon as I had time, I started novels. I wrote shorter things before and then longer things. Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed, which is high fantasy, was my first novel that I was able to sell to a major publisher. And I was very lucky to get that book published. And I will tell people, networking, if you want to be a writer, always network. Here in Alaska, it was our visiting writers series. Jane Yolen was one of the first people who sold a short story of mine, bought one. And so she bought a short story. Through her, I was able to find an agent. Through that agent, I was able to sell a book. So it really comes to networking locally with writers and taking every opportunity to go to writers' conference. And if there's one thing I can say to people, it's that network and, go and find out. So I was very fortunate. Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed went on to get shortlisted for a pretty prestigious prize called Best First Fantasy from the International Association of the Fantastic and the Arts. And after it was published, my editors at HarperCollins said, "Oh, you're from Alaska. You really should give us an Alaskan book." And I said, "Oh my gosh, I can't write an Alaskan book. I had majored in anthropology here in Fairbanks." And I took that very seriously. I said, "How could I ever live up to the importance of the culture? How could I ever represent that?" But finally, they just kept asking and said, "Okay, if I want a contract as a writer, I'm going to give them what I want. But I'm going to write a book about a woman who's a shaman." So this is now Summer Light and Daughter of the Shaman. And that's a little bit of my fantasy back voice coming in. But it's built on research that made me feel as if I could hold my head up and carry the culture that I was writing about with respect. And it was really important. So I did those two books, spent a lot of time doing research, both ethnographically in the museums, talking to people, everything. And after that, there was no contract for another book. So I went to work for a number of years. And when I was done working, the kids were older and out of the house. And more recently, I said, "Gee whiz, my old books are turning brittle. The pages are getting old." And the only way to do that these days is self-publishing. So I brought them out.
Okay. All right. So there's a journey to self-publishing, and I wish you all the best, especially during these times when we're a little bit trapped, but I'm sure within a few months you'll be able to get out and yes, spread the word. You're already doing a good job. Everyone who's listening, you can find out more about Elise's books if you go to her website, elisegutenberg.com, and tell your library to order one. That would be a good way to get the books as well. Our libraries, we can do that all online. So I'd like you to specifically say, we were talking earlier about when you do this kind of research, whether it's historical, anthropological, and you're collecting all these notes, What is your process to make it weave in with your fantasy or your imagined fictional plot? How do you do that without overwhelming the reader?
That's a very good question. And one of the best things that I do so that I don't spend too much time just getting lost in the research and not working on the story itself is if I have a detail that I want to get to, I will leave a blank and highlight it in yellow on my computer. I work on the laptop all the time. And I'll say, fill this in later. So that's how I will separate the research time from the actual writing plot time. So that's one thing that I do. Go, like, okay, get this note here, finish it later. But to not overwhelm the reader is pretty much the way I write. I read every single thing out loud to myself constantly. I read out loud as I'm writing. And when I start to write, I write every day. I start at about 9 o'clock and write for, you know, that's about 5 hours a day till my eyes are tired and my back hurts and I'm getting bleary eyed and brain dead. But I always start with reading the last thing that I wrote the day before. And that brings me into the story. And then I read out loud and I go like, oh, this just got kind of boring. And and I cut. I do a lot of writing at the beginning and then cut back more and more as I go to what is essential and what just takes too long and what slows the plot down. And I cut more than I write. If I cut something, even though it's really hard to cut it, I'll put it at the back end of a chapter first. And then I'll trick myself to saying, oh, that's okay. I'll look at it later. And then later I'll push it a little further. But the way, the real answer is I read everything out loud and sometimes go away for a few days, go away for a few weeks, work on some other part and then come back. You'll see what slows it down.
You know, what I also wanted to ask you, and this brings it to mind, is that your dialogue and the way the characters all talk to each other, there's a lot of humor there. There's buddy banter, and there's kind of people that are not sure that this is a friend or an enemy. And I love that. I love the characters' names. They're very Dickens-like, you know, where they kind of bring out who they are and you kind of think about what they look like. But the dialogue, how do you work on the dialogue? Do you have friends that you talk to about it?
Not very much till the very end. No, it's really all me. And again, it gets back to reading it out loud. I wanted the power we share to be fun. I thought of my other books as pretty serious, heavy. There, people are fighting and life is at stake at every moment. And I want to have fun with the power we share. So there's humor. And that was just important to me. I wanted that to be in the story. I consider it light entertainment. I wanted a book that was entertaining. But I'm glad you noticed that the name sounded Dickinson. and that's real. And Shakespearean too. There's a little bit.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Right, like who was dressed up in men's clothing when? I just saw that as quite a bit in Shakespeare's comedies and was having fun with that.
Yes, that's what I meant when I said at the beginning that I so enjoyed reading this at this time because it was light, it was fun. There were great, you loved all the characters, even, you know, the characters you weren't supposed to love. And, you know, it was just a real, really fun book to read. So are we going to meet these people again? Do you have future plans?
I am working on a sequel. Yes. Mm-hmm. The end leads right into what will happen next. But it's going to be set at a slightly different time ahead, what comes next. So I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll be looking forward to it. Do you have a title or a working title?
Yes, it's The Power We Sow, S-O-W, The Power We Sow.
Right. All right, perfect. Well, we've been talking to Elise Guttenberg. You can find more about her at her website, EliseGuttenberg.com. You have been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. And I'd love for you to join me next time to talk more about books and authors. And you can listen to past shows from the podcast page. Listen to this one if you joined us halfway through on the website, kptz.org, and make a donation to the station as well. David Kurland is our editor today who will smooth out all the rough edges. Thank you to all the volunteers and supporters who make this radio station possible. See you next time.